From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 19th day of April, 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Kurt Kimmel. He's the Senior Grains Analyst at Bates Commodities in Normal, Illinois. And later in the half hour, we'll discuss the cash grain market with the folks at the Andersons right here in Champaign County. In the second half hour of our program today, on many of these stations and online at willag.org, we'll talk with the president of the American Soybean Association. In agricultural news, Colin Peterson says he does not have an agenda for change related to the 2012 Farm Bill. Hearings on the legislation begin this week. Senators Kerry, Graham, and Lieberman are putting the finishing touches on the climate change bill, but it looks like they'll miss the proposed Earth Day introduction. And a jury in Arkansas has levied a $50 million fine on Bayer Crop Sciences. The Liberty Link settlement is to be parceled out to a dozen of the state's rice farmers. Dave Dickey will have details of these stories later in the half hour. And hey, in just 26 minutes, we'll check in with the folks at Chesapeake Energy to discuss the global agricultural weather forecast. And it all happens right here on this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media from the University of Illinois.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Tom Testel and Morris at 815-941-2184. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
In Chicago on this Monday afternoon, futures finished like this. The nearby May wheat at $4.67¾, a settlement price down 22¾. July soft red at $4.79½, down 23. And the September at $4.96½, down 22¾. In Kansas City, July hard red winter wheat at $4.93¾, down 23¾. May corn futures, $3.47¾, 16¼ lower. July at $3.57¼, down 16¾. September, $3.67¼, 16¾ lower. And December futures for the corn at $3.78, down 16¼. May beans, $9.76¾, 8½ cents lower. July at $9.86½, down 8½. August at $9.81¾, down 9 cents, and November at $9.56, 9½ lower. May meal at $2.83.90, up $3. Oil down 87 at $38.93. April live cattle at $98.95, up 20. The June's down 15 at $94.50. April feeders at $1.12¼, a dime higher, and April lean hogs today at $77.72, down 8 cents on the afternoon. This is Illinois Public Media. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures, $83.25 a barrel at the trade, down $1.42. May ethanol at $1.54¼, down 3¼. Natural gas at $3.95¾, down 8¾. Heating oil or diesel fuel, 5¾ lower at $2.16 even. And the gold futures now, down $1.10 at $1,135.20 an ounce. The Dow at 11,059, just about 40 points higher. And the U.S. dollar at 80.99 is up 0.17 on the afternoon. The CRB index at 273.23, down 3.06. And Goldman Sachs at 535.55 is down 8.62 for the day. Here's what the weather forecast for the two-state region looks like as prepared by our own folks here on staff. Open field conditions will continue, they say, through the first half of the work week in Illinois and Indiana. A slight chance of a few showers on Wednesday will be the first potential interruption to field work. More widespread rain expected to arrive in western Illinois on Friday. That should remain in the area through the middle of next week. Temperatures will show a moderating trend through the week. The threat of frost, that's right, frost, will be confined to the eastern sections of Indiana on Tuesday. Then an increase in cloud cover will help to eliminate the cooler overnight temperatures from returning. Wind speed will remain light enough for any spraying activity to continue through midweek before gustier conditions are expected to arrive. And finally, after the extended period of dry weather, the flooding situation is minimal in intensity and confined to just some basins near the Mississippi and Illinois rivers. The rain expected later this week, not expected to get in great enough intensity to cause any real cause for concern. More on the weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour and talk to the folks from Chesapeake Energy.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
The closing market report is made possible in part by a grant from Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois, a full-service commodities firm with two toll-free lines. In Illinois, 800-252-2013. In Indiana, 800-637-3123. Or email to Cooley at admworld.com.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Monday afternoon. Here to check the agricultural futures markets with us is Pete Manhart of Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. He's filling in, of course, for Kurt Kimmel, who's away this afternoon. Hi, Pete. How are you?
Good.
Well,
very good.
Boy, it made for some interesting trade today. We had a pretty good week last week across the grains and oilseeds floor. Everything was up. Everybody was feeling a little bit better. I don't know whether anybody really turned around and got bullish, maybe a little friendly, although on Commodity Week they still thought things would move lower, and apparently they were right, at least today. Futures were down pretty sharply.
Well, the fundamental outside markets were pushing lower after the move up last week, a little bit of profit taking. A lot of last week was fund buying, which we had fund selling today, and a lot of last week was short covering, which we had none of today.
Can it continue?
I think we can continue a little bit lower, but I think this time of year we're always after a move up, ready for it to back up some and then try again. So I think we will try back to a little over 4 in that corn, and I think the beans will try back at that 10.06 area. But it's not just going to go straight up or straight down. We're going to have glitches like today in it. Today we took most of those, 22 cents we'd gained in the corn out of the market. Mm-hmm. We're still 60 cents above the recent lows in the beans.
What is the trade expectation for this afternoon's crop progress report?
It's expected to be somewhere 20 to 23%. 20 is a record. I don't know where it will come in, but central Illinois through this area, I'd say, is at least 50.
Well, we'll find out, I suppose, won't we? And we'll get an idea at 3 o'clock, and then we'll hear about it again tomorrow morning. Again, on this program tomorrow afternoon, we'll hear the statisticians and get their reports directly from Illinois, Iowa, Indiana, Minnesota, and Nebraska. Those are the five top corn-growing states in the nation, so be sure to tune in. That'll come around 20 after the hour or so tomorrow in the 2 o'clock hour. Okay, so we're looking at a marketplace that's pretty variable over the last 2 weeks. Do you think that this kind of volatility will settle out of the market very quickly? Or are we in for a very fun ride from now until, I don't know, June or so?
I think we are in for a ride up and down until we get pretty well done planting, or till we decide that, yeah, it's going to really be dry, or we're going to have plenty of moisture. I think those outside factors of weather, the planting progress, and then just where are we physically in the world with grain, and what's the outlook for the economies of the world.
What do you think? And from time to time, especially when we talk to you, you talk about dollars per acre often rather than price. What do you think that producers ought to be aiming at this year as compared to previous years? Is it very much lower in terms of their margin?
Well, hopefully they've got a lot of it already protected and or sold. I can't remember what the insurance number is, but that's somewhere near $4 on corn.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd hopefully that they got an awful lot of it sold above 4, protected above 4. But as far as dollars, I think their investment is not quite as high this year because fertilizer in general went down from a year ago levels. But everything else is pretty well still up there, and we could easily have no drying costs this year versus last year. $20, $30, $40, $50 an acre drying costs. So it looks relatively good for this year right now, but we need to be protecting and or selling when we have bumps up like the last week.
I know a bit later in the program, Dave Dickey, when he gets to the agricultural news, is going to talk about anhydrous ammonia shortages and that happening out west. Did most of the producers that you deal with get all their anhydrous on, or are they still working with that?
I have people that, instead of anhydrous, went to the 28. I have people that they planted their corn first and now are side dressing. I have people last week and the week before in areas where they were four plants around them were out of anhydrous. So it's a mixed bag depending on where you're at. The pipe is not big enough to get all the anhydrous we need here for this spring. So there will have to be other ways to put on nitrogen.
Well, they've got plenty of time, it appears, at this point to make that happen. We're early enough in the season. Although it's going to turn a little wetter over the next several days, it seems.
In this area and lots of areas we talk to, they would welcome a very good rain. And the places they're waiting to plant because it's too dry.
All right. Anything else to add on the corn and the bean markets before we take a quick look at the livestock?
It's the two season, too high, too low, too hot, too cold, whatever. So, I mean, be ready to take advantage of bounces up.
All right. What do you see in the livestock market for the day?
Livestock, today we were mixed, cattle up a little, hogs down a little. We continue to think that we do have more highs coming in cattle, but they've gone so far that they might back up a couple times before going higher. Hogs, I don't know what to think of them, but they are up there at a nice price range. I don't know if we can go a whole lot more or not.
Thanks so much for filling in, Pete.
Thank you.
Pete Manhart is with Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. He joins us here on the Closing Mark Report. That happens on a Monday afternoon.
Support for WILL comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks by developing dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is at stuart-peterson.com.
Hey, please do visit our website. The address is willag.org. That's willag.org. Or you can always call us and listen to a bit of today's analysis and either the opening or closing numbers. We post them at 10:15 and 3:15 to 217-333-3434. That's 217-333-3434. Now here's Dave with the news.
In agricultural news, House Agriculture Committee Chairman Colin Peterson says he does not have an agenda for changing policy, but he wants agriculture groups and others to examine what works and what can be improved in the 2012 Farm Bill debate. Hearings will begin this week, with Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack testifying on Wednesday. Peterson then intends to hold another hearing in Washington, D.C., with academics and economists to give a broad overview of the farm situation and then move to hearings around the country. Peterson continues to question the role of direct payments in setting cash rents or land values. Further, Peterson is looking at whether crop insurance can be structured in a way to help cover a farmer's whole farm risk rather than picking winners and losers in price protections being offered. Senators John Kerry, Lindsey Graham, and Joe Lieberman are continuing to put the final touches on their proposed climate change bill, but it now appears they will miss the anticipated April 22nd introduction date. The three reportedly are still receiving input from their colleagues and tweaking their draft in an attempt to accommodate the wishes of potential supporters. Their resulting bill could be ready to be introduced by next week. The U.S. Department of Agriculture unveiled plans Friday to help propel non-corn-based advanced biofuel from small or pilot production levels to commercial-scale output through loans and subsidies. Under the Biorefinery Assistance Program, the USDA would provide loans of up to $250 million to develop and construct commercial-scale biorefineries. An Arkansas jury says that German conglomerate Bayer Crop Science should pay a dozen Arkansas farmers nearly $50 million for allowing a genetically altered strain of rice to escape into the commercial market, damaging rice prices in 2006. The farmers claimed an experimental rice strain developed by Bayer called Liberty Link was allowed to make its way into the stream of commercially marketed rice. No nation had approved genetically modified rice for the marketplace. A shortage of anhydrous ammonia fertilizer has emerged in parts of the Corn Belt. Supplies are especially tight in northeastern Kansas and northwest Missouri. Parts of Illinois are also seeing spot anhydrous shortages. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. That's public radio for the farming world. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, the host of the Closing Market Report and of Commodity Week. In the second half hour of this program today, stay with us if you can or listen online at willag.org. We'll talk with Rob Joslin. He's the president of the American Soybean Association. Now up next, the latest cash rent figures for the state of Illinois have been released. I'll have more on the USDA report. The United States Department of Agriculture has been collecting cash rent data for a couple of years. The director of the Field Crops Division at USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, Joe Persaki, says the information is used in part to set payment rates for CRP, or Conservation Reserve Program acres.
The county cash rents was mandated in the 2008 Farm Bill. So last year was the first year, this is the second year, that we've conducted and published that information. And really, we work very closely with FSA on that one because they're using that with the CRP, you know, what's the proper value for CRP arrangements and such like that. So it's a joint relationship that we have going on with FSA.
FSA is the Farm Service Agency, or the primary way producers and landowners interact locally with USDA. Persaki says the cash rent survey is pretty popular with farmers. This year's data, which indicates cash rents paid by county in 2009, did not show any real big trend in cash rents over the 2008 crop year, at least in the state of Illinois. University of Illinois Farm Management Specialist Gary Schnitke looked at the data and says it's highly dependent upon the county.
This year, it was sort of interesting. About 41% of the counties had cash rent increases, 37% had decreases, and the remaining 22% of the counties had no changes in cash rent from 2008 to 2009.
Still, NAS reported average cash rent statewide for Illinois declined from $170 per acre in 2008 to $164 per acre in 2009. That's a statewide decline of 4%. This 4% state decline differs somewhat from other sources. An earlier USDA survey indicated cash rents in the state had increased by 4% from 08 to 09, and results from an Illinois Society of Professional Farm Managers and Rural Appraisers also indicated cash rents had increased between 08 and 09. U of I's Gary Schnitke says the unpublished cash rent data from the Illinois Farm Business Farm Management, or FBFM, record-keeping program supports the NAS cash rents.
Yeah, what we did see between those two sources was that FBFM did show some counties that had declines in cash rents, and there was a correlation of about 0.46 between FBFM cash rent changes and NAS changes. That it's really difficult to estimate average cash rents in Illinois because there's plus or minus $100 in rent differences across farms within a county. So what farms get sampled will influence the average.
Rental rates generally positively correlate with farmland productivity. Consequently, the highest cash rents in the state are in central Illinois, with eight counties having an average over $200 an acre. Lower average rents were in southern Illinois. The lowest average was in Williamson County, having an average of just $67 an acre. The NAS data for many counties in the United States is available for download from the agency website. It's at www.nas.usda.gov. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason. By the way, if you'd like to read Gary Schnitke's Farm Economics Facts and Opinions columns, you can always do that online. They are available as soon as he produces them at www.farmdoc.illinois.edu. And usually he and I get together and we produce a podcast. So you can sign up for the podcast for that one at the Farm Doc website. Again, the address is www.farmdoc.illinois.edu. Not only does Gary put out a podcast there, but you can get the weekly outlook from Daryl Good there. And that comes out as a podcast too, all at farmdoc.illinois.edu. Time now to take a look at the agricultural cash grain market for the day. Jenny Springer is here. She's with the Andersons, located right here in Champaign County. Good afternoon to you, Jenny.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Did farmers call up and say, hey, what happened?
Yes, they did. Actually, it was more like, what the heck happened?
And did you have a good answer?
You know, we compile as much information as we can, obviously, but I think China's economy and stock market has something to do with it. Also, you know, the Goldman Sachs, you know, fraudulent issue that's going on. I mean, I think that's got a huge weight on our outside markets right now, and, you know, the commodity markets are following.
You know, as the commodity markets fell, did your cash basis widen out or not, or did it narrow up with them?
Actually, we narrowed up 2 cents today. We're at 10 under on cash corn, so.
And you expect that will continue to be the case as producers are in the field planting?
I think we'll see basis get stronger, especially into the summer months. And if basis doesn't get better, there'll be more, you know, premiums out there for number two yellow corn.
How much of the grain do you think that the Andersons has purchased from their client base at this point? Are you at 65 or 70 or 80% or 40% of your purchases?
I think we're somewhere more in the 50 to 60% range. I think some guys still have quite a bit of corn, you know, left unpriced, not on basis, sitting in the bin. And I think in hopes of keeping good corn through the summer is going to pay off for them. So.
Do your colleagues and you agree that that's more or less than what you normally would have priced out at this time?
I think we're a little less than what we normally would be, especially with the stuff that's in the bin being unpriced as well.
Okay, then that brings me back. Have they remembered to go check their bins?
Let's hope so. I know they've been busy in the fields, and, you know, we're seeing this great stretch of dry weather. Some guys have even said, though, that they're, you know, waiting a little while to keep planting because it's so dry. You know, they need a little bit of moisture in the ground so that they can get back in and really feel comfortable with the, you know, seed they're putting in the ground.
Yeah, it's not.
So hopefully they're taking that time to go check their bins.
Well, hopefully they will. I suppose you'll find out pretty quickly if there's any that have gone bad, they'll come flying into you. Tell me about what you believe will happen in June and July with the marketplace and basis.
Oh, I think you'll see, like I said, I think you'll see basis get better through the summer months, as it always does, and the need for corn and the need for good quality corn. You know, I think there are guys that did take the extra time during harvest to get stuff dried down to, you know, a level that it will keep to the summer months, you know, and we'll see those premiums come to, because there is so much corn that did get put in at bad moistures and is going bad, and the guys just aren't paying attention to that. So I think that's going to become a very important issue.
Quickly on the soy complex, do you think supplies are a bit tighter than what USDA is projecting at 190?
Honestly, I really don't have a good handle on that. I mean, we are seeing a lot of guys don't have beans on farm, and they have sold their beans out of DP and storage. So as far as, you know, beans in our area come this summer, I think it's going to become a little tight in this area just for the simple fact that guys don't have it on farm.
And Jenny, the bids for the day?
Cash corn, 338. Fall corn, 348. Cash beans, 967. And fall beans, 916.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Jenny Springer is with the Andersons, joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Monday afternoon. Back in 2 minutes when we'll take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast with the folks at Chesapeake Energy.
It's National Amaretto Day. It's also Garlic Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1877, Ollie Evinrude was born. He invented the first practical outboard motor in 1909. The idea came to him while rowing a boat to a picnic one day. He decided there had to be an easier way to move a small boat on the water. He patented his engine a year later and a new industry was soon created. In 1904, Richard Plow was born, an American ecologist. He was the founding president of the Nature Conservancy, and he also helped found the World Wildlife Fund. He also was one of the first to recognize the dangers of DDT on fish, frogs, and birds. In 1916, Ephraim Shea died, an American logger. He invented the Shea-geared small steam locomotive to haul heavy logging trains at low speeds over rough terrain with poorly laid, uneven track. In 1975, Percy L. Julian died, an African-American chemist. He worked on synthesizing various compounds from soybeans. One of his creations was a foam fire extinguisher refined from soya protein used by the U.S. Navy in World War II. And in 1995, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that alcohol content could be listed on beer labels, overturning a 1935 law that had prohibited it. And that's This Day in Agricultural History.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report on a Monday afternoon. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Tug Gleason. On the line with us to take a look at the agricultural weather forecast is Mark Russo. He's with Chesapeake Energy in Chicago, Illinois. Good afternoon to you, Mark.
Good afternoon, Todd.
It's not as warm as it has been here the past several days, but it's still dry. I suppose one or both of those are going away.
Well, at least from a temperature standpoint, yeah, we do have to deal with slightly cooler than normal temperatures for another several days, although that will return to more seasonal levels. You know, we're kind of used to already the ultra warmth that we saw back earlier this month, so kind of skewed our attitude more towards the summer type pattern here, and we were teased by that, and now we're kind of back to reality as we get into this week here. So kind of seasonable temperatures this week when you average out the next 7 days, and that looks to persist for the most part in the next week. Really no sign of any exceptionally cold or, for that matter, exceptionally warm weeks coming up, you know, basically through the end of the month. Now, from a precipitation standpoint, we are going to see dry weather continue across the Corn Belt throughout the bulk of this week, with the next opportunity for rain coming up over the upcoming weekend. That does look like a widespread rain event across much of the Midwest, which, while it'll slow down planting a little bit, is probably more beneficial considering that some areas of the Midwest have trended drier here in recent weeks.
It will be fairly welcomed, I would think, by many a farmer across the Midwest to put dust down. I would think they might want something approaching an inch. Are they going to get that much?
Yeah, we do expect that. In general, across the Corn Belt, we expect about 70% coverage with amounts in the range of 3/10 upwards to 2 inches. And even here across Illinois, we have a really good chance here for getting the 1-1.5 inch amounts plus with this precip event coming up.
And then if you look out west, what do you see for the winter wheat crop?
Well, we see very good conditions here as spring growth continues. Similar to areas of the Midwest, we have had some areas trend drier here recently, but over the past 2 to 3 days, actually extending back in the late last week, we saw big rains develop across the southern plains, especially in parts of western Texas and western Oklahoma. Some areas picked up over 4, 5, 6 inches, which actually those areas have been dry here of late. So as a result, it's been a very beneficial situation. Big boost to soil moisture reserves, and that is creating a very good yield prospects here for winter wheat in the southern plains.
And then drop back down into the Delta region. They were awfully wet early on, got in a little later than they wanted to. Did they get all caught up?
They should have here, Todd. They've trended drier over the past couple of weeks, which has resulted in corn planting and other summer crop planting being quite rapid here of late. We are going to see some rain over the upcoming weekend, but not enough to cause any kind of significant slowdown. So with that soil moisture boost, they're going to be in very good shape as well.
And turn your attention to not South America, but China, where they should be beginning their growing season.
Yeah, but they're not doing it this year, at least for the corn crop up across Manchuria. Very cold temperatures and active conditions through the end of the month are going to keep them out of the fields.
We'll talk with you again next week.
Great, Todd. Thank you.
Thank you much. Mark Russo is with Chesapeake Energy. He's in Chicago, Illinois. He joins us here on the Closing Mark Report on a Monday afternoon. We'll say so long to several of our radio stations at this point. If you'd like, you can always stay with us online at willag.org. In a moment, we'll talk with Rob Joslin. He's the president of the American Soybean Association. I'm Todd Gleason. This is Illinois Public Media.
Learnard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learnard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learnard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
The following program is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. This afternoon, Rob Joslin, a soybean producer from Sidney, Ohio, and the president of the American Soybean Association, is on the line with us to talk about old trade policy and international affairs at the Soybean Association and what his organization does. Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us. Please, if you could, first, Rob, tell us where you're located and how you came to rise to the presidency of the ASA.
Well, I'm located in a little town, Sidney. It's north of Dayton. It's on the west side. If you draw a line between Toledo and Cincinnati, I'm about the middle dot you would put in that area. But it's been a long journey. I was asked to run for Ohio, I think in 1998, and it's just been basically been a pathway journey since then. It's been a lot of fun. And I've made a lot of friends and had a lot of good opportunities. I'm honored to be president of the American Soybean Association this year.
You know, I made note under the bio that the ASA has up that you actually have more acres of soybeans than you do of corn, or at least did last year or when they wrote the bio. Is that still the case?
Yeah, it's pretty close. I'm roughly a 50-50 blend, so one year I might have a few more soybeans, but a few more corn. But I always try to list the soybeans first because that is a significant part of my life right now, working on soybean policy for American farmers.
Policy issues. Let's take some of those things up. Biofuels at this point are a very hot topic, continue to be that way, in part because of national security issues. But, of course, biodiesel and biofuels from soybeans has not gone nearly as far as quickly as ethanol and fuels produced from corn have. What kinds of policy issues does the ASA have on the hopper?
Well, the first thing we have, and this is our number one priority of all priorities we have right now, is we need to get reenactment of a dollar per gallon biodiesel tax incentive that expired late in 2009, and that's extremely important in the industry. It ends up being the way, that's for a 100% biodiesel product, you get dollar a gallon. So if a farmer buys, let's just say a B5, a 5% blend, that subsidy ends up being a nickel a gallon. But I think people have to realize there is not a better product. It's got the best energy gain of any of the renewable fuels is biodiesel. It helps the greenhouse gases, and, of course, it helps the domestic security by being a home-raised fuel. It's a good story, and we just need to get that tax incentive back in place immediately.
Why did the tax incentive, other than its sunrise and sunset, why did that tax incentive go away? Why did Congress not come back and take care of it?
Very, very simply, it passed the House and got bogged down. I don't think anybody is unaware of the fact that Congress the last several months been focusing on health care. It got bogged down in health care discussion last part of the year, and I'm very disappointed our legislators let it expire. We're working very hard. We got new bill passed both the House and Senate. It has to be done what they call reconcile. There's got to figure out how they're going to do what they call the offsets, which pay for. It's not a done deal yet. It's closer than it was a month ago, but it's not a done deal. We're working very hard to get that back in place for the U.S. farmers.
Did it surprise you that, and the U.S. farm industry has been taking this up since last fall, earlier than that, in fact, trying to make sure that did not go away. Did it surprise you that Congress's attention was so focused on health care that it simply let things slip through the cracks? And I don't know whether this one slipped through the crack or there's something yet unbeknownst behind it that somebody else is talking or whispering into the ears of congressmen and saying, you know, we don't know whether we really want this to happen.
Well, I really want to clarify and deliver the message. We worked on this very early. It was a one-year extension in late in 2008. We thought it was extremely important to get it in place again earlier. Plant managers put together budgets like everybody else, and the longer this goes without being in place, the harder it is for a plant manager to plan for the following year. And I did think they would finally get it done. I was extremely disappointed with all the people working on this. Why they did it, I really hesitate to actually make a statement there, but I do think they bogged down and focus on that big 800-pound gorilla in the room, health care. I believe they also, at the same time, maybe left some needed governance dropped by the wayside, such as biodiesel. This not just helps American farmer, it helps American consumers. And we just have to keep delivering that message, and I really believe we will be successful, but the longer this goes being shut down, that's a loss of market that we will struggle to recoup very quickly.
Are the biofuel plants, the biodiesel plants, in trouble at this point because of it?
Oh, yeah. The vast majority, I'm very concerned, the vast majority, I'm just frankly sitting idle. We got this production, this domestic production capability, this job, this economic development that we need in this economy right now. I mean, it's just sitting idle, and I'm very frustrated that we're not getting that bill passed, and we're working very hard. Your representatives of ASA and our lobbyists in D.C., this is our number one priority.
You know, do you know how many biodiesel plants there are in the United States and how many are idled at this point?
Not off the top of my head, but the vast majority of them, I'd say 80-90% of the total production capabilities are shut down. But I don't want to say that definitively, but the vast majority of them are shut down because they need that dollar a gallon production to help their budget bottom line. They're working on a very razor-thin margin, and you take that away from them, they can't produce on the hope that this is going to come and without knowing when. They just can't run a business that way, so they simply had to shut down.
Let's talk about some different things that have come out of Washington, D.C. There are some consumer bioproducts as well, and a USDA program called the Biopreferred Purchasing Program. What is it?
It's actually a program put in place in the 2002 Farm Bill. It was enhanced, expanded in the 2008 Farm Bill. And it's a very simple program. It encourages, expects government purchasing agents to buy a bio-preferred product. And that has to be a USDA-certified bio-preferred. But right now, we have 2,700 and some of those that are actually already been approved to consumers, for example, as floor cleaning agents, carpets, things like that. Now, there's some criteria on that. It has to be commercially available logistically to serve the market in sufficient quantities. And this is what something I think most consumers need to hear at a competitive price. See, the farmers all realize that the products that we produce, our manufacturer, can be done at a competitive price. And that's what we expect the government to do, is buy those products. Right now, if I remember right, there's 500,000 buildings owned by the government, 600,000 vehicles, and I believe it's 1.8 million civilian employees. And the bio-preferred product is just puts a pathway in place for all those buildings, all those cars, and all those employees to purchase and use bio-preferred products.
And when they do that, what happens?
Well,
What happens on the farm, but what kind of incentive is the bio-preferred purchasing? What is it that is the government subsidizing that in some way?
There's no reason to be subsidized because it's at competitive prices. It just says if you have a product based on, let's just make it.
So if it's two equal products, please choose the one that's bio-produced. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. Gives the preference to the bio-produced product. And a real reason for this is the reason so important. That's usually you develop that demand, and those products will be the vehicle to expand into the consumer markets.
And finally, let's take up an issue that I know you've been involved in, and certainly that producers all across the Midwest are interested in watching. The Department of Justice has been looking at competition within several portions of the agricultural industry. Seed was one of the most recent, and I believe you had somebody from the ASA that was involved in those conversations.
Yes, we had a farmer, Ray Gasser, from the state of Iowa, can't call it testimony because this was structured a little different. He'd answered the questions. There was a series of panelists. I think there were three panels put in front of both the Department of Justice and the USDA, like Secretary Vilsack, put in place in front, and they answered questions based on, and the first panel, the only one that's held so far, has been on competition in the seed industry.
And what kinds of discussions took place? What did they suggest? The competition was limited, that was a bad thing, that there needed to be something done? Were they perfectly fine with the competition that was available?
Well, Secretary Vilsack, I did have a chance to meet with him several weeks ago, and he said he didn't know. But he heard enough concerns across the farm country that he thought it needed to be answered. So that's the reason he asked us, the Department of Justice, to begin this process to look at overall competition. We all know that we need competition in our supply chain and also really in our purchasing chain. I think the next hearing is in the milk industry, to be held in state of Washington, to look at, is there enough competition in the buyers of agricultural product. We need that competitive to make sure that we get a fair price in the marketplace. We also need that competitive side in the input side. The American Soybean Association, one thing a lot of farmers don't realize, and I think this is fairly important, the first Roundup gene was introduced in 1996. It comes off a patent in 2013. And one of the concerns we have is a pathway, once it goes off patent, to make that technology available for other seed companies to develop and as a platform to use that to introduce other traits and also to have export approval. That's kind of the simple answer to a very complicated question. But even though a farmer's going to be allowed to grow those soybeans as, let's just say, what we call now brown bag because it'll be off patent, we still have to have export approval. We need to make sure that China, Japan will accept those beans once a farmer grows them.
We've been talking with Rob Jocelyn. He is the president of the American Soybean Association and a farmer from Sidney, Ohio. More with him in a moment.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers. Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
In business news, Eli Lilly and Company today says its first quarter profit fell 5%. Eli Lilly also reduced its full-year profit outlook due to health overhaul-related charges. The Indianapolis company says it earned $1.25 billion, or $1.13 per share, in the 3 months that ended March 31st. That's down from the $1.31 billion, or $1.20 per share, last year. Toyota Motor Corporation has agreed to pay a record $16.4 million fine to U.S. safety regulators for delaying a massive recall over defective accelerator pedals. The $16.4 million civil penalty against Toyota is the maximum allowed by U.S. law and the largest that the U.S. Department of Transportation had ever sought. Without the cap, government lawyers said Toyota could have faced fines of $13.8 billion or $6,000 for each of the 2.3 million vehicles that were sold with defective pedals. Toyota declined to comment on the fine. And Citigroup Incorporated today reported a surprise first quarter profit as trading revenue offset losses from failed loans. Citigroup says it earned $4.4 billion after payment of preferred dividends. Economists had expected a loss. And that's today's business news.
Support agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
We'll continue our conversation now with Rob Joslin. He's a soybean producer from Sidney, Ohio, and the president of the American Soybean Association. I'm UofI Extension's Todd Gleason. This program, of course, a production of Illinois Public Media. When we last talked to you, Mr. Joslin, you were taking up the issue of brown bag seed and Roundup Ready, one. And when it goes off patent, what happens with the availability to plant soybean seed that has been kept back by farmers? Your suggestion was that there wasn't really a good pathway yet at this point for that to happen. I know from discussions with the seed, with the soybean breeders here on campus and around the Midwest, that because that goes off in 2013, but they can't really use the seed yet very well as a breeding tool, that even if it goes off, there might not be seed available really with the latest genetics or good genetics to put back into the ground. How does ASA plan to take up these concerns?
Well, we're working with the technology companies. A lot of people were talking about Roundup Ready 1, but this is just simply the first technology trait has come off patent. We're trying to get a pathway developed so that breeders can have access to those, that genetic material, and there's also what they call the package, which is needed for registration overseas. We're trying to have a pathway that the industry, the seed industry, can get access to that prior to the patent expiration for development of the new seed, so that they have the latest seed for the farmers available soon after the patent expiration.
Right. But even with the patent expiration, the breeders, they really have to have that. They have to be able to work with that well ahead of time. I know here on this campus at the University of Illinois, and I suspect at other campuses, that the soybean breeders there, and there aren't very many soybean breeders left in the United States, have maybe some access to the Roundup Ready gene?
That's exactly what we're trying to work with the technology companies to have access to the gene and the information prior to the patent expiration, so that they can be working on it. Even though they would not be allowed to introduce a variety, they could work on the plant development prior to expiration. That's one of the things we're working on, is what's appropriate amount of time to make that information and material available to them for breeding purposes.
Right. So I assume, because you have to work with the individual companies on this issue at this point, but are you also talking to the patent office about how to develop a pathway that would simply be in the patent when it's issued?
No, we are not working with the patent office. There's also an oversight group called BIO, which all the seed companies are members of. We're working with BIO, and that's a voluntary program. And of course, we'd like to see the voluntary approach, but we also believe that we need the needs of the U.S. farmers need to be protected first. So we're working very hard to make sure that their needs are protected. We're working individual seed companies and also working with BIO to get these questions answered for our farmers.
What other issues do we need to take up before I let you go for the afternoon?
We got so much going on. It's a great time to be involved in agricultural policy. It's a challenging time. I have a lot of concerns because I think the American farmers don't realize that we have less and less legislators in both their home state, in your situation, Champaign, Illinois, or Columbus, Ohio, or Washington, D.C., that understand our issues. That the EPA, I believe, is committed to regulating greenhouse gases. Even though the legislation may not move forward, we have to work to make sure that we have regulations in place that the farmers that have the smallest amount of impact as possible on our U.S. farming capabilities. We met just last week with the EPA. We sent a farmer to have that discussion with other commodity groups, which I understand was very beneficial meeting. So I think the American farmers have realized that climate change on their farm, either legislation or regulation, is not dead. And I'm working very hard, the American Soybean Association, working very hard to make sure that we can get the best for our farmers on that. We're working on trade issues. There are so many things. I know you have limited time. We believe we'd like liberalization of trade to Cuba. That's a good opportunity for U.S. soybeans. Where else? Just depends how much time you have here.
Well, let's go with the trade issues. I hadn't thought about talking about Cuba and opening that market up. It is something that U.S. farmers have done to some extent in recent years under the Bush administration, I know. And you're hoping to liberalize it and open the market just a bit more? How big a marketplace do you think that might be?
Well, right now it's relatively small, $134 million of U.S. soybeans. That's a very small market. And we believe that if the restrictions are liberalized, because it's only 90 miles off our shore, that we could greatly expand U.S. soy exported to Cuba. We also, of course, advocate free trade agreements. There's three that's been sitting on the hopper since the Bush administration, just sitting there on the shelf without any effort by the administration to move them forward. Colombia, Panama, and South Korea. And those are great markets for U.S. soybeans, and it's very disconcerting to me that we had a very solid, secure market because we have these free trade agreements not moving, that we're losing that market.
Mr. Jocelyn, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Rob Jocelyn is the president of the American Soybean Association, joined us from his Sidney, Ohio farm. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.